They've condensed that into me saying, yeah, I've traveled the world, I've stayed in hostels, I've met women half my age, and I've left a trail of broken hearts in my wake. Now, when I watched that back, I thought, uh-oh, that was really the first time I'd seen the editing just make me look just like such a creep. And I thought, oh, no, this is going to be so hard to watch some of this back.
Wow, that is some voice. Deep, rich, and subtly Australian. You could be forgiven for thinking Hugh Jackman is the filling in this episode of Bridget's Bagel. But he isn't. No, I've got a very different kind of showman to entertain you this time. He certainly entertained me, along with the other 1.48 million people in the UK who got hooked on Married at First Sight Australia, where they got to know Mike Gunner very well indeed. I forget exactly when I got dragged down under for those rocking romances, but as I recall, at the time, we weren't allowed to mingle in masks, so the touchy-feeliness of the reality show was very welcome. And now, even though it's sunny outside and you can meet for a plastic cup of wine under an outdoor heater, I'm still fixated with the show that makes arranged marriage sexy. And it's as addictive as those nutty little wafers they sell in Costco. Do you know the ones I mean? Anyway, I digress. I'm on season 5 of MAFS, that's the acronym, and struggling to understand why the so-called experts teamed jocular single mother Jo with sour-faced Sean. Matchmakers are rarely as snappy as the little chocolates they're named after, and they regularly mismatch singletons, whether they're Orthodox Jews, Muslims, or from any other faith or country that suggests strangers can meet, say I do, after meeting for the first time. It might shock you to know that a statistic from as recently as 2017 revealed that 55% of marriages worldwide are in fact arranged. The controversies around forced marriage are well known and often horrifying, but I'm keeping this bagel light because Married at First Sight was all about fun, particularly when the couples argued, and never more so than in season 6, which consumed the nation from the moment it aired, despite having been made in 2019. That series, 6, actually accounted for the top 4 rated programmes on television back in January, and it was only BT Sports coverage of the Premier League game between Spurs and Liverpool that gave it any other run for its money. Of course, being made in a PC year, that's pre-COVID, there were a lot of spoilers floating about on social media, which I ignored because I wanted to watch every second of Mike and Heidi's relationship unravel in my own time. Boy, was that good telly. Good enough for me to want to find Mike Gunner and ask him everything about why he signed up to be part of an experiment that would result in him being rebuked for calling someone sweetheart. Charming and erudite, Mike was willing to tell me absolutely everything, almost, about the manipulating that goes on behind the scenes at Married at First Sight, the dates that male contestants don't really plan. In fact, he pretty much told me everything that the producers would prefer us not to know about a show that really is a far cry from reality. Listen to this podcast and you will learn everything you want to know about the couples, the craziness, and the truth about angry Ines and juggling Jess with the pout. Sorry, Jess. Nothing was off limits with Mike, not even his mother's Jewish gynecologist. As interviews go, it was plain sailing, and that really isn't meant to be a dig at Heidi's hatred of boats. But the real story about that Titanic final date in the last date episode is really a revelation. No, thank you, Mike, there was no holding back when it came to sharing all the things we didn't know about his TV wife. I guess the only real difficulty about Mike was getting the timings right for our chat, what with him being in Australia on the Gold Coast and me in London. Plus, I had to get to talk to him before his bedtime, which is rather early.
Well, I mean, you know, I like to be sort of getting myself ready by about 10 o'clock. Yeah, I don't want to be up too late. I suppose you get in a bad habit, don't you, of going to bed late? And thankfully, probably the last couple of weeks, I've gotten myself to bed early, and I'm finding there's a lot of benefits to that.
Because you look, I mean, as you demonstrated in Married at First Sight, particularly fit. There was no denying that in terms of eye candy, you definitely were top of the league in the show.
Oh, you thought so?
Yeah. So, yeah, running along the beach in slow-mo, it was like watching Bo Derek or something.
You know, I wasn't a fan of that. I thought they made me look a bit silly in my backstory.
Oh, did you think, right? Now, this is what's fascinating to me. As someone who has spent their life having to go into rooms and speak to people I'd never met before, did you feel that they completely reinterpreted you as a person in order for you to be on the show?
I think they look for archetypes. I think they're trying to make you into an archetype. You know, they do some interviews previous to the show and get a sense of who you are and figure out the theme of your character, your personality. And I think they got me wrong. And it's a shame, because for the first couple of weeks of the show, I thought I looked a bit silly. I really do. And, you know, the editing is a powerful thing. I mean, the magic of television, you know, they can edit you to appear a certain way, and that doesn't necessarily reflect who you are. And it didn't sit well with me for the first couple of weeks there, but I think eventually they figured out, okay, we got this guy wrong. We'll sort of be more realistic as to, you know, projecting who he is, our image of him. I think it changed at some point.
I think it was very much, I mean, part of the reason why people became so addicted to it was the personalities. And the fact is that I was very much on your team, because I think it's very much, we live in the age of, well, as you well know, hashtag Me Too, and the way that women are presented, the way that women are responded to, has kind of changed dramatically over the past 2 years, really since the Me Too Brigade started. And the normal kind of behavior between men and women seems to be under a magnifying glass now, because your responses are not the responses that certainly I grew up with.
Yeah, look, I think you're right. I think that the dynamic has shifted, you know, that the whole paradigm, it's what used to be acceptable is no longer. And I mean, I'd like to think that men and women are equal. Bad behavior from guys or girls should be sort of treated equally. I mean, there were some things that I did in there I wasn't proud of, some silly things, you know, but I was called out for it really harshly, whereas some of the girls seem to get away with murder. I mean, you look at the way
that's what I mean. That's exactly,
you know, the way
what
that Inez
I mean.
Spoke to her husband, Bronson. I mean, she was, you know, yelling at him profanities and insulting him. I mean, people thought it was hilarious, and yet he says one thing to her and he's called out on it. I mean, I think I got castigated for having used the term sweetheart, you know, to that Elizabeth. And then, you know, she berated me for that. And then in the next breath calls me honey. And it's, you know, no one bats an eyelid. In fact, I've made this point before that, you know, her whole narrative was that she kind of felt as though she'd been body shamed by this guy, Sam, throughout not only our season, but the following season, because she appears in the next season. And yet, you know, she had called him names that could be considered body shaming also. So there's just this recurring double standard, you know, whether the guys were hauled over the coals for just about anything and the girls just got away with murder. And it kind of, it never ceased to amaze me.
we saw you for the first time, and you said that you had broken a lot of hearts, which we could see why visibly. But what on earth made you do this in the first place?
Well, okay, let me talk you through as well that scene that you saw. And I'll have to explain this because it's quite interesting. You know, I did they call it a master interview at the very start. In fact, that scene was shot at my parents' place in Sydney. You know, the questions my producer, who's basically sat beside the lens of the camera, says, "So, Mike, you know, have you done much travel?" I said, "Yeah, I've traveled quite a bit. You know, I traveled all over the world." She said, "Okay, well, typically, how long do you travel for?" And I said, "Well, it depends on what my budget is. You know, if I'm on a tighter budget and I want to travel for a longer time period, then I'll sort of be a little more frugal with my spending." And she'll say, "Okay, well, what kind of places do you stay at?" And I said, "Well, I suppose in those cases, I'd stay in cheap hotels and hostels." And she'd go, "Okay, well, what kind of women do you meet?" And I said, "Well, unfortunately, you know, I'm meeting women half my age because that's sort of who's traveling. But they're the ones having all the fun as well. And, you know, it's nice to meet people that way." And she said, "Would you say you've left a trail of broken hearts in your wake?" And I said, "No, I wouldn't say that I've left a trail of broken hearts in my wake. But I suppose, you know, nobody wants to break anybody's heart." I said, I suppose I have broken some hearts. Anyway, they condensed that into me saying, "Yeah, I've traveled the world. I've stayed in hostels. I've met women half my age, and I've left a trail of broken hearts in my wake." Now, when I watched that back, I thought, uh-oh, that was really the first time I'd seen the editing just make me look just like such a creep. And I thought, oh, no, this is going to be so hard to watch some of this back. I had a feeling that they were going to do this, and they did.
It's an age-old thing to, you know, leave a hell of a lot on the cutting room floor that would have made that person look good. It's a terrible, terrible. I mean, that's why I contacted you in the first place, because my feelings for you at the end of, well, for all of us that I know, at the end when you came back for the reunion show, it was brutal how the edit was purely in favour of Heidi and made you look like you were a complete misogynist who didn't give a damn about women.
Yeah, I know. I totally agree. Yeah, you're right. And what a shame. But you know what's interesting about that, Bridget, is that different cultures seem to have received it differently. I've said this before, actually, and that the European sensibilities kind of tend to speak to me and my personality, and they can understand it. They saw it beyond the editing more so than they did here in Australia. And in Australia, I got my ass kicked, you know, by the media and the public in general. Of course, I had a lot of support too, but far more people were critical than they were in support of me. And that was kind of difficult, I must admit, because I was very sincere about it. And, you know, you asked about why I went on. I mean, I was in my 40s. I thought, I'm single. I haven't been meeting people the traditional way. I mean, I'd done the online thing. I've been to bars and, you know, I've been doing some dating and whatnot. But I thought, you know what, I'll give this a go. If I meet a great girl, then, you know, what a fun story to tell. You know, what an interesting way to meet. And it would have been. I mean, I'd still be with her if it was going to work out, but it wasn't going to work out. And so I walked away we both walked away. But I think there's a lot of people that do shows like this that, you know, that's not their motive. You know, they are looking for something else. They're looking for a profile or a bit of fame or something, you know, maybe a fun experience. I guess I was looking for a fun experience too, but ultimately it would have been good to meet someone. But yeah, so that was my motivation.
Yeah, I can see, yeah, that's true, because you're right, absolutely. People do go on to launch their reality star career, and it can be very, very profitable. What fascinates me about it, though, is that the experts on the show, because John Aiken is a former cricketer who's been married for 13 years. So his relationship of the three experts is the longest. Mel Schilling, she's a dating and relationship expert who met her partner on a dating website. And then Tricia Stratford is a clinical neuropsychotherapist who specializes in the neuroscience of relationships. The neuroscience of relationships, that went over my head a little bit, I must confess. But she met someone on a blind date. But, you know, there's no one amongst those experts who has what I would call, there's no one celebrating an anniversary equivalent to your parents.
No. And you use the term expert. I mean, and that neurological, that is not an exacting science. I'll give you the tip. I mean, people that imagine they can give you advice on how to, it's fantasy. You know, these experts, some of their advice is helpful. But like you say, I mean, look at their track record. You know, they're no better off than most. I mean, they've got, you know, sorted histories in their own relationships and broken marriages, this, that, and the other. You're right. They were my parents together. I think it's 55 years now that they've been together. And, you know, they had sound advice. It was from the heart. You know, they didn't take the scientific approach, the analytical approach, where they broke down each relationship into its component parts and tried to examine and unpack. I mean, that just doesn't work. There's more feeling to it. There's more emotion than you can account for. And I think that those guys, you know, and the other thing is that people sort of miss as well is that I think they consider themselves sort of sociological experts also. I mean, they narrate you through the dinner parties. I mean, their opinions are no more valid than anybody's. And oftentimes they get it wrong. You know, they only see half the story and they go off, you know, half cocked and they make judgment and opinion and criticism based on what they're seeing in front of them. A lot of the time it's pretty obvious, it's rudimentary stuff that they're talking about, but they'd have you believe that they had the answers to everything. And, you know, bear in mind that each of them wear an earpiece, and ultimately it's the executive producer. You know, she is prompting them to say in their professional speak what she wants them to say and the questions that she wants them to ask. So you got to remember that they're actors, essentially.
I have to say, actually, there were times when they really felt like actors. I mean, it was a bit clunky, wasn't it, their conversation? And, you know, they were being so, it made me, you know, sorry, I'm so cynical about this stuff, but it really made me laugh. And what really made me laugh most of all was when you had to go and get relationship advice from Jess. That you went out, you were paired off with her, a woman that they knew obviously was going to be inflammatory anyway for you.
Right.
And she was supposed to give tips on how you should handle your relationship with Heidi.
Can you imagine this? What could I have possibly gained from meeting with her? I mean, what was she going to tell me? And then I was hauled over the coals for bloody not chatting with her about it. When I got home, Heidi said, "Oh, well, what did you talk about?" I said, "Well, it wasn't about us." And she jumped up and down. "Oh, well, hang on. What? Why not? What's going on with that? Why didn't you spend your time wisely?" It's like, oh, excuse me, come on. As if I was going to gain anything by talking about it. They wanted a confrontation. Hang on a second. I've got a dog chewing at a box.
Oh, you've got a dog there too.
Yeah, I got a little dog. She's got a little noisy collar and she's banging it against her.
So's ours. We've got one who's 11 years old, Dumbledore, and then we got another one 2 weeks ago who's 11 weeks old.
Right.
So it's chaos.
They sound adorable.
I love that they sent you off with Jess. It was priceless, laughable to me. That you know, I think that a kind of age gives you wisdom. And it is fair to say that you picked up on the fact that you were surrounded by millennials mostly.
Right.
And that you could sit back. Often you did sit back, physically sit back in the chair and must have been thinking, what is this?
I did. I mean, you know, the thing you got to remember as well is that those dinner parties, I mean, I think we went to 7 or 8 of them. Look, honestly, by the fourth one, you just didn't even want to be there. These aren't people I'd mix with. I mean, there was probably 2 guys and maybe 2 other girls who I could be friends with in the real world. The rest of them, honestly, I could take or leave them. And you had to feign this enthusiasm in seeing them and talk about your comings and goings. And then it would all descend into chaos. And my instinct is just to not have any part of it. And I think a lot of the time it was sheer boredom and frustration at seeing other people trying to explain them, express themselves and explain their situations, that I just felt like I had to come in and sometimes adjudicate. And you didn't see a lot of it. Well, you didn't see a lot of it. You only saw the stuff where I got really spicy. I mean, I solved a lot of problems that were happening around the place as well. Like, it wasn't all confrontation from me. I also, you know, I was criticized for having given advice, and yet, you know, I'm old enough to be some of these people's father. And here am I, you know, giving a little bit of relationship. I mean, there was no one else beating down their door to try and help them out, believe me. And so, you know, I'd say a few choice words in their ear, and oftentimes it was pretty helpful, quite useful to them. But then I was criticized for giving advice. It was like, all right, well, would you rather I just sit back and say nothing? I'm a bit of a problem solver, Bridget, you know, and I think that's the difference.
Now, I noticed you were doing that the whole time. And actually, I applauded you for it, because if I'd been sat at that dinner table, I mean, it would have gone a lot further than throwing a glass of wine over someone. Can I just ask you, did you actually eat, though? Was there food?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was. You know, it was good food, too. I'm vegan, as you know. And at that time, I was vegetarian. So I was still eating eggs and things. But so I had a pretty specific diet there. And, you know, they would always go to great pains to have mine separate to everybody else's. But no, the food was good. So for the first, you know, 30 minutes, you'd sort of have your dinner and just sort of get some light chatter out of the way. And then it'd just kick on, or kick off rather. And you might be in that dinner party for 6 to 7 hours.
Oh my God.
You know, yeah, you see it as what, an hour or something, but that is condensed from, and what was interesting is that at the end of the night, nobody really knew when to leave. Like, I mean, it would be 2:30, say, in the morning, and we've literally sat down to dinner at, say, 8:30. So it's 6 hours later, and everyone's, by this time, you've already gotten drunk and you've sobered up, and now you're kind of just a bit seedy and tired. And you don't want to fight. It's over. You know, the night is over. Nobody actually, John doesn't come in, or the executive producer doesn't come in and say, okay, guys, night's over. We sort of saw ourselves out when everybody was just too exhausted to talk anymore. It was like, all right, I think we're done.
Oh, my God.
You know, see you tomorrow.
That's crazy, isn't it? So that take, I mean, in a sense, that also removes the realism of it, because a real life dinner party is over in a few hours. Is it true, I read somewhere, that when you were about to have a row, that they would tell you to hold fire and wait for the crew to get there?
Yeah. Yeah, that was, you know, that was something they impressed upon us earlier. They said, look, you know, if you're going to have a row with someone, or if, even with your partner, and there's no cameras around, hang on to it. And when we are, you know, ready for the shot, then you can fire it off, and which is completely unnatural, obviously. That would never happen in the real world. So, you know, you might hold on to that for several days, because you might not see that person unless it's with your partner. Of course, you're with them all the time, and you would have rows. I mean, you couldn't avoid it. And oftentimes it was off camera, and they'd say, all right, well, what happened? And, oh, well, she said this and I said that, and she stormed out and I was all sad about it. And they're like, all right, well, we can't sort of play all that through. So what they do is try and then pick it up with an interview. You know, you'd have to sort of give all the detail in the interview, but they weren't happy if it didn't play out on camera, because it was more difficult for them to use, you know, to stitch the story together with stuff that you couldn't see.
Or to stitch up the story, it actually is a more accurate way of saying it, probably. It's
honestly, I could tell you, I'll give you three examples of being stitched up. I'll start from closest to the end, which would be soonest in your memory, was that boat, right? Remember we went on that final boat?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I believe on camera it was Heidi said, oh, I can't believe he took us on a boat. And, you know, he knows I get seasick. You know, what was he thinking? He's so selfish taking us on a boat. I had nothing to do with that boat. She knows full well. All these dates that you see, you know, that the guy will be like, oh, well, I went to all this trouble and I've set up this lovely picnic for her, and, you know, this is a big romantic date. The guy's done nothing. They got an art department for that stuff. And by the way, the guy doesn't get to choose it either. Because they said to me, oh, what do you want to do for your final data? So why don't we do something like ballooning, you know, lovely hot air ballooning. I've never done that before. Maybe a beach picnic down on Bondi, or, you know, maybe we'll go in a park or something. And then the boat. And she said, oh, what about it? I said, no, not a boat. Please not a boat. She hates boats. She won't even get on a boat. And Heidi was sat next to me while I had this conversation. And the producer said, well, look, they're leaning toward a boat, Mike. I don't know. Can you talk around? I said, it's going to be difficult because she doesn't like him. And you know this. So, you know, it's not going to work out well. Lo and behold, yeah, it was a boat. Now,
oh my God, that's just terrible.
Well, hang on. And it gets worse. So my producer, we're on the boat now. And she said, oh, look, Mike, are you interested in climbing up this crow's nest of this beautiful old boat? I mean, of course I am. I mean, like, yeah, this is an amazing old boat with sails, and we're in the middle of Sydney Harbour, and, you know, there's this crew and they're up and down it and everything. And I thought, yeah, for sure. And so I said to Heidi, come on, we'll go up the crow's nest. She said, I'm not going up that damn crow's nest. It's too dangerous. I said, all right, well, I said to my producers, look, maybe I shouldn't. She just wants to sit here. She's feeling a bit seasick. I don't want to really leave her be. She goes, no, Mike, it's going to look great on camera. We got the drone out and everything. And I said, yeah, you're right, it will be. I'll go up quickly. I was up that bloody crow's nest for about 10 minutes. And then when I watched it back, if you look closely, when I'm climbing back down, and in fact, the narrator says, she says, Mike's finally ready to come back down and join Heidi. And what they've done is they've actually darkened the scene of me climbing down. It looked like it was at night. So it looked like I'd been up there for about an hour and a half. I was up there for 10 minutes. But when I got back down from the boat, from the crow's nest, they said, oh, Mike, can you go to the back of the boat and just wait there for a while? I'm sat there waiting out the back for honestly about an hour and a half until it went dark. And then they said, oh, okay, you can come up and join Heidi. Now we're ready to shoot these scenes. And it looked like, and then the next breath, it's like the whole, my whole country is like messaging me, and I'm on Twitter, and they're, you know, I'm trending on Twitter. How dare he take her on a boat? He knew that she got seasick. What was he thinking? And I'm like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. So that's one.
Oh God, that's unbelievable. I mean, there you are. You're doing your King of the World from Titanic moment. And she was like sinking below. I kind of figured, because, yeah, carry on anyway. I don't want to miss a moment of this. Carry on.
Right. So then there's the not bringing her food home. You remember that one?
Yeah. Oh, God, yes, yes. That was a big thing people raised with me. Yeah.
Right. At the time I'm shooting that, I'm a 44-year-old man. Do you really think that I wouldn't bring dinner home for my girl? Come on. Right. So I was leaving to go grab some food from our version of Sainsbury's, a little supermarket down here. And I said, hey, it was about 6:30. I remember it well. I said, hey, I'm going to go grab some. Are you hungry? She said, oh, no, I'm not really hungry. And I'm about to walk out the door. She says, all right, look, I am a bit peckish. Could you grab me some chips from Oporto, which is this store where you could, you know, you could buy burgers and things. I said, yeah, that's fine. I said, I think it's going to be shut though. I think it shuts at 6. She said, no, shuts at 7. If you're quick, you'll get there. And I said, okay, well, I'll see how I go. Lo and behold, it's shut. And then, so on the way back, I thought, all right, I'll buy some potatoes and I'll just cook, because I'm a pretty handy cook. You know, I can knock up some bloody pan fried chips in, I don't know, 20 odd minutes. 30 minutes. So I've got potatoes, I got oil, I knew I had salt at home and some baking paper and all the rest of it. So I've come home and I had some pasta for myself. I just wanted a pasta salad. So what did you get me? I said, well, I got you some potatoes because the shop wasn't open. And she went off her brain. Oh my God, you're never going to cook them in time. I want to go to bed soon. I'm like, hang on, it's not even 7 o'clock. Like, how do you want to go to bed now? Like, I can have these on a plate and you can be eating them in probably 30 minutes. This is crazy. You went and got yourself all this stuff. Why wouldn't you have gotten me some of that? I said, well, you didn't seem very interested. Like, it was a last minute thought as I was walking out the door that you even wanted potato chips. I've got the ingredients for that. Is that going to be good enough? So no, I'm furious. Went to bed. So I'm like, oh, here we go. This will be a thing. So then we're bloody sitting on the couch or something, and the next thing, oh, he didn't bring me any food home. And I'm just shaking my head going, this chick is stitching me up here.
There's no timeline for falling in love with someone. You know, people say they do it in seconds, you know, that they have love at first sight. And I think that Jennifer Lopez sang that song, I Could Fall in Love with You as a song that Jennifer Lopez sang. And also Kravitz did a song like that. But when you said that to her, I completely got that. You'd known each other like a minute in terms of relationship. And yet she was so, I thought it was a wonderful thing to say to someone. And yet she was so mortally offended by it.
Yeah, look, to be fair, the wording of that, I must admit, came out wrong. And I will tell you that in the moment, I recall it well. It was a bit, I was trying to be, and I think I even mentioned it on camera, so I was trying to be a bit charming. It's something, that's how my dad would put it. Like, he was a bit, my dad's a bit cheesy. Like, he's a lovely man, but he tells dad jokes and he says cheesy things. And I get it from him. And I was trying to, you know, I was trying to pay myself out a bit, kind of like, you know what? I could fall in love with you. That's kind of how it was meant to come out. But I think I threw the word try in there or something. It just sounded, what she should have done was just let it wash off her, you know, like, oh, well, whatever. It was just a misstep, a slip of the tongue, no big deal. But it became another thing that I got my neck wrung for. And I'm just thinking, but do you know what? I'll tell you something, Bridget. This was a girl who has media training. I mean, she's been in the media for a lot of years. She's been a radio host, television presenter. And little did I know that, you know, she was well aware that if you are going to be on camera, there needs to be something to, you need a storyline. You need a little bit of drama. And these little moments, they made the cameras swing around to us and examine what was going on. And I truly believe that she was fully aware of that. And so these little things were made into big things, which, I mean, it was exhausting, you know, because I'm thinking, oh, we could get through this thing and it's pretty well unscathed. I mean, we're the oldest couple here. Like, we should just get along and it's no problem at all. We could be like a Cam and Jules, just nothing's a problem. But everything was a problem. And I think that was because she knew that we would have more camera time if we had these little bust-ups.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yours was definitely, I mean, obviously, Sorrel was good value, but it was the fact that you were, she was spot on with that, because you actually, it's sad to say, but Cam and Jules were the most boring part of the entire season.
I was happy to be the boring one. You know what I mean? Like, I would have been happy with that. You know,
we'll never be boring.
Fly below the radar. Seriously, I mean, I use the term damage control, but I just felt like I never had any clean air. You know, I felt like we'd go pretty good. And then it's like being on a highway and suddenly you got to slow down for a speed bump. Like, that's what it felt like. As soon as you started getting a nice bit of momentum, something just jumped in front of us and you had to hit the brakes. It got to a point where I thought, what is this all about? Like, are we here? Is this girl here genuinely to meet someone, or does she just want to get famous? Like, it just felt like she was kind of disingenuous a lot of the time, and I didn't know whether I should commit my heart, and ultimately I didn't, I suppose, in the end, because I said, all right, well, I pulled the pin on it. I just said, no, yeah. I don't think that you truly feel about me like you say you do. I know that you mentioned, you know, Inez, and I believe she came from, it could have been Bosnia back in the day. Now, I know refugees. I've met them. I've all over the world. In fact, little known fact about me is I worked in an orphanage in Central America in El Salvador for 2 years.
Wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. So I've seen real suffering. You know, you don't get suffering like that. What these people have is first world problems. Now, that Inez, did she come from a war-torn country? Yeah, absolutely. When I asked her specific questions, because I know my history. I mentioned the name Slobodan Milosevic, who was, you know, in charge of that whole mess. She didn't know who he was. You know, so this is a girl that's just seen an opportunity to play the I mean, don't buy into a word that girl says. And I sincerely mean that. You know, she insulted me so heavily off camera. My family, you have no idea that she's so cruel and hurtful. I don't think she's all there. I really don't think so.
Well, there was that. I mean, you could see from episode one, she went in with an agenda. I've got to tell you, talking to you like this, it feels to me that you are better equipped to host Married at First Sight than to be a participant, because your wisdom about people, and obviously having traveled as extensively as you have, suggests right. that you would be better placed. Can I ask you, if you'd been given those people, presented with those, taking yourself out of the equation,
yep.
who, is there any of those people that you would have paired with to have made it work better?
Yeah, definitely. I haven't actually considered that question until just now, to be fair. But yeah, there was, I would consider some of those people well-adjusted and others far from it. It felt like there was no in-between. You were either a normal, well-adjusted person, someone like, say, Tamara, you know, that came in halfway through. She was a normal, easygoing girl. Lauren, you remember Lauren that was with the Virgin?
Yes, yes, yes.
She was really easygoing. She was easy to get along with. She had very few, you know, very little criticism and judgment of anybody, you know. And then on the side of the guys, you know, Mark was a really easygoing guy, nice guy. Mick, Mick had his moments, but he was a nice fella, you know. Really, he and I are still friends to this day. But yeah, he's a normal guy. Bronson, really nice guy. Even Dino. Most of the fellas in there were super easygoing, but probably more than half the women, honestly, I don't know where they found them. They were just next level.
That was my takeaway from it, that the women were unhinged, a lot of them, that I had no sympathy for their position. You know, even when you were sat on the beach, I know it was edited and whatever, but when you said, yep. look, I'm not your therapist, that's my go-to line, because I am a very practical person who, when something's wrong with people, I'm like, right, we need to do this, right? We've got to go here and get that. And if people are looking for hand-holding and therapy time, I'm not your girl, okay? It's just not me. I'm practical and want to dial a number to get that kind of assistance. So when you said that, I just thought, yeah, I get this guy completely.
Look, and Bridget, can I tell you something? You know, it's funny, my girlfriend is actually in the next room folding her clothes, and she's probably so sick of hearing about this. In fact, I know for a fact that she is, because everybody asks about it, and I honestly sympathize with it. But this will probably be the last podcast on the subject I ever do, frankly. So you're very fortunate in that respect. I didn't realize going in that it would consume so much of your life. And then there'll be days where I don't even think about it. And then somebody comes up and asks for a photo and I'm like, oh, that's right. Of course. Yeah. Okay. Hey, how you doing? And honestly, there was a little bit of PTSD there for a while. You know,
Like army time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think my biggest issue was how I was misunderstood and misrepresented. And I'll give you an example. And you mentioned that thing on the beach. And I've got to be honest with you, Bridget, that is not something that I would say out of fresh air, just off the bat. You've got to know that I'd heard that story. Now, you've got to remember, this is a 38-year-old woman, okay? Yeah. This is a problem that she had when she was 15 years old, which is 23 years previous. Now, this was a problem that, you know, where she was in her teens. Bear in mind, I moved out of home when I was 16, and a lot of my friends did as well. So she was 15. She was living in government housing. Now, I mean, I later found out that this wasn't, you know, third world government. I mean, this was comfortable. She was comfortable, but she didn't get along with her mother. Her mother had asked her to leave home. And so she was telling me this story. And anyway, you know, she finished her education. She went on to do some pretty good things. You know, she was, like I said, television host and radio and whatnot. But it was just this nagging, I suppose, feeling for her, as though part of her youth had been kind of lost or stolen from her, you know, in this time where she was in foster care. Now, I listened to that story intently, and I gave her all the advice and encouragement and support that I possibly could. I said, well, you know what? We can work through this. This isn't something that should consume your life, and you shouldn't let it worry you and have caused you all this heartache for all these years. I mean, this is a pretty easy fix, really. I think I can help you through it. No, Mike, you don't understand. It's more profound than that, and it's deep-seated, and you know, I've worked on it for so long, and I haven't gotten anywhere with it. And I said, well, you know, don't underestimate me. I think I can be a good listener, and I want to understand, and I want to get to know you more. I mean, I went through all this, Bridget, and I'm talking, you know, not just on the beach that day, but the night previous and the night previous to that. So we kept going over this story. Now, the part that really got to me was that I didn't think she listened to anything I'd said. It was as if, you know, I was never going to be able to help her, and she was just convinced that this problem was too great to overcome. The adversity would never be conquered. You know, by the time we sat on that beach and I'm just getting ignored. And by the way, I mean, I got my own crosses to bear, right? Like I've got some trauma, but I've let it go and it's in the past. But it felt like she didn't care about any of that. This was all about her. And at this point, I started to feel like she was just playing the victim. And it was like, look, this is a 23-year-old problem that you have that honestly doesn't sound like a big problem to me, something that should be easily enough overcome. And you are not listening to me, and you're basically telling me to shut up and listen to this story over and over again. And I think I came to the end of my tether, and I just said, look, I'm not your therapist.
And that was the only bit they showed. Yeah. I think
that's the only bit they showed.
Stitched up like a kipper, personally. That's what I think. That's what I think. And full power to you for coming out. I think you would have done a better job being the person that matched them up, certainly the one that gave the advice. That's how I see it. You mentioned to me, you know, you've got your tattoos that we saw quite a lot of. Are any of them dedicated to anybody?
Yeah, to be fair, you know, it's funny that I got one on my forearm. That most of them are just, I don't know, I'd walk past a tattoo shop and had an inkling to walk in and see what kind of stuff they had. But there is one on my forearm.
In other countries? Or just
I got one on my leg from Thailand. I got one on my other leg from El Salvador. I got one on my forearm from Nicaragua. The one on my stomach is from Indonesia, Bali. And I think I got one. Oh, I got one on my another one in my arm from Bali as well. I spend a lot of time in Bali. Bali's like our Magaluf, you know, or our Tenerife. So that's where we all go to holiday.
Have you ever been to Magaluf?
No, I haven't. I haven't.
It's not like Bali, I can assure you.
Oh, isn't it? Okay.
If only it would be, no, Bali.
Like Ibiza or something, maybe.
Yeah. But you've got them. So they're from all of that, and they're not for any. They're not significant in any way then?
One is I've got one on my forearm of a woman. When I lived, when I was in El Salvador, I spent a lot of time in Mexico, and I was surfing in Mexico. I had a surfing accident and I very nearly drowned, actually. I came very close to death, and a young lady swam out on her or paddled out on her bodyboard, and she sort of hauled me to safety. And I have a bad back ever since then. I've got bulging discs and whatever. I got a bad back. I think she saved my life. I genuinely, in the moment, I felt like she had. And so I got her tattooed on my forearm. But apart from that, no, nothing particularly significant. Yeah.
That is really significant. And I'm going to tell you why, particularly. I have a tattoo on my wrist. I have several, but mine is for my father, who actually drowned. He drowned in Israel.
No kidding.
No, he drowned in Israel in 1989. There was a riptide, which in that region where it was, they've since built 30 years on.
Break wall.
Yeah, they put a break wall there. But at the time, it was wide open and it was October and the riptides were really strong. And they'd had a number of incidents because as a journalist, I got heavily into it afterwards. But it was a Friday afternoon and, you know, big waves. He was a fantastic swimmer. But he was up to his knees. And what they never teach you, of course, is that you're meant to let float into the current, not fight the current. And
yeah, that's right. With and across it, they say.
Yeah. But yeah. And so I got that tattoo when that happened with him. So that's one now. But yeah, I completely see why you would have that woman tattooed. Is that her on your arm?
Yeah. Her name was Yahira Linus. She's 21. We never had, everybody sort of suspects that there must have been some romantic connection. I mean, I was twice her age, so no, there wasn't. She just saved my life, so I felt like it was a nice gesture.
Wow, that's amazing. That's really amazing.
Yeah.
Growing up in Australia, because when we first connected, you mentioned to me, you said, oh, you're Jewish. Did you ever go out with Jewish girls? Have you been out with Jewish girls?
You know, it's funny. I spent a season in the Greek islands. I worked all over the Greek, had a ball, and I met so many women from Israel. Oh, just lovely, you know, just really charming and very worldly, very classy and mature, I found, and well-educated, you know, bright girls. I'm probably generalizing here.
Yeah.
I've never dated a Jewish lady. No. You did ask me about bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs. I have been to those.
Well, as a kid you used to go to friends' ones or something.
Yeah, my parents would take us. You know, my parents are from Sydney. There's quite a big Jewish culture in Sydney. And, in fact, my mother's, I don't know why I'm telling you this, but my mother's gynecologist was a Jewish guy called Schwartz. What was his first name? Anyway, someone Schwartz, lovely guy. His wife, Judy, and they were in babysitting club for many, many years. Like, you know, my child, the kind of adults that you would call them auntie and uncle kind of thing. And so they weren't family, of course. But, we went to their children's bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs. And, oh, I tell you what it's a hell of a celebration. You guys really turn it on.
Yeah, no, I know. It's a wonderful time. And, of course, we've been robbed of so many over this whole time. It's been crazy. Do you know, it's funny, isn't it, in a way, because, you know, just to kind of round things off, Orthodox Jews obviously are part of that. There's a number of communities that have arranged marriages, some of them not good, in the case of, you know, the forced marriages in Pakistan and beyond. But what do you think about it?
It's a terrible idea. And then if you look, you cannot in all honesty expect a couple to survive that's had no previous. I mean, it's a lottery as far as arranged marriages go. I mean, if you're living in a family and in a culture where your whole life you knew it was coming, you know, you've built yourself up to it. You know, you know that there's a chance that you might meet someone that you. I'd like to think that if you did meet them, like you said, you know, in your Orthodox Jewish society, if the girl met the guy and she completely objected, she just said, "Nah, mum, he's a total creep, not interested, not feeling that whatsoever," the parents could, you know, there must be some mechanism whereby they can overturn it and say, "Okay, sorry, little Haifa, he's not for us." I was trying to think of a Jewish name there.
Little Haifa, that's brilliant.
So little Haifa, I'm sorry, you'll have to wait till next season, you know.
Oh, that's hilarious. Are you going to, I mean, you were an electrician before. You've now, what is your company now that you've got?
Well, I'm a tradie. So, yeah, I'm an electrician. I've travelled a lot doing that job and it's been really useful. You know, you can pick up work pretty much anywhere. In fact, I lived in London, for that matter, for 2 years working as an electrician. Part of it was that I didn't like the idea of working in an office. You know, I when I left school, it was to go to university or go out and do something, you know, more practical. And so that sort of came along and I thought, well, I'll give this a go. And I did. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being outside, working with my hands, being more physical. I did always have a bit of a hankering for something more creative. And so, well, now I do cosmetic tattooing. I actually do tattooing for men mostly who are bald. I make them appear as though they have a shaven hairline.
Oh, really?
And the way you're looking at me right now is that you probably don't know that I've actually had it done myself.
You're kidding, really?
No, I'm not kidding you. My head is actually tattooed, the hairline itself.
So did you lose your hair when you were young then?
Yeah, like when I was 24 or 5 or something like that, yeah. So I had a little bit on the sides and the back, you know, like a horseshoe. Several years ago I had that treatment done and now I perform it on men and women to a lesser extent. You know, women with thin or fine hair, I'm able to make them look a little bit more full.
Wow, and I so, love yeah, that. That's
yeah, it's pretty
I'm always
cool.
Doing hair stories. I've done so much here about hair and about, you do it in Australia. Are you planning to advance it kind of?
Yeah, I'm coming to England to teach it.
You're kidding, really?
No, as soon as I don't have to go into lockdown when I come back to Australia, I've been offered by several studios to come over. I teach it here as well. It's quite a sought after treatment because, you know, you can make good money from it. And so everybody wants to learn it. And I teach it out of a studio in Brisbane. And I not only do I do treatments there, I also have my own studio down in the Gold Coast, which is where I am now. Yeah, so that's my new career, I guess you could say. As well, I've done a bit of acting also.
And, oh, yeah, you had to. You just had to.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's not something I pursued much. I think people have kind of hit me up and said, hey, can you be in this little thing? Can you put your head in front of camera? And I've really enjoyed it, I must say, and I'm going to do a little bit more of it. It's something I enjoy. But you know, there was a lot of criticism, actually, when I went on Maths that I was an actor. And I don't define myself. I don't feel as though I am an actor, believe me. Anyway, there was criticism thrown my way. I just certainly don't identify as an actor, but yeah, I do a bit of that.
I wouldn't say it should be a criticism because I thought that your diction, your kind of, you know, your delivery, it was. I mean, I suppose the thing is that it was because everyone else, next to everyone else as well, obviously you did stand out as someone who was, I mean, and that said, I can see why they paired you with Heidi because she was, you know, she knew how to kind of present, as it were,
yes,
and in a way that the others certainly, I mean, Mick, bless him, bless him. I actually would love to go to his farm. I thought it was most endearing that he wore, I loved the fact he wore his work boots and he wasn't wearing, you know, Manolo Blahniks or Jimmy Choo's. I thought it was fabulous. But they all seem all loved up now and so are you, which is brilliant. When do you think you'll come to London when they open up the world?
Yeah, definitely. I think I was asked to come over there for a few different things, but these have just sort of fallen by the wayside because I think people anticipated, you know, COVID being gone by now. So I think everybody's missed out on opportunities for that reason. But yeah, I definitely want to. I was 20 years ago that I was in London living there and I miss it and I loved it very much the first time. So I'd definitely like to spend some time there and come and say good day.
This has been absolutely amazing. I think that you shone in that show and I don't care if I get hate mail because of it, because I believe that sometimes you can see the truth amongst all the fibs, as it were. Yeah. I thought it was brilliant.
So you know, Bridget, look, I definitely made mistakes. There's no question. I mean, and I probably should be held accountable for some of that stuff. But, you know, one of the things I've learned a lot of lessons, not just about myself, but about the world as it goes. And I've noticed that, you know, everybody, maybe they are entitled to an opinion, but it feels like now more than ever, people are less hesitant to express their opinion than ever before. I mean, I still get people every day that will say the sweetest, kindest things, the most charming things to me, and then in the next breath, you know, the next message will be someone berating me. And I've grown a thick skin, but I've also learned a lot about people and I suppose how they think and what makes them tick and how they feel they can interact with you. And I suppose I wouldn't have seen that any other way had I not done that and been through that experience.
And didn't we love going through Mike's experience with him? Of course we did, regardless of whether we agreed with him or not. I have to say, I did agree with him most of the time. And though I've always felt Australia was just that little bit too far as a realistic destination, Married at First Sight has kind of changed that and sparked my interest. So if they ever agree to let us back in, I'm definitely going. And who knows, I may get to visit Melbourne's best bagel bar, which is called Schmucks. Yes, I know, but I think I'll get over the name when I get to tuck into the Nutty Monkey Bagel, which has a filling of blueberries, Nutella, banana slices and almonds. I'd be more than happy to share it with Mike, who got me through one of those lockdowns. And best of all, he's coming to London to improve lost hair days for a lot of bald men. On a final note, and in keeping with the theme of romance at first sight, there's a new children's book by Natasha Wing called Bagel in Love, which is all about a little bagel who dreams of entering the Cherry Jubilee dance contest. But no one wants to be his partner. Okay, it's a children's book. But Married at First Sight for Bagels? Well, that's a possibility. This was Bridget's Bagel. Hope you join me again.
Dunkin' Bagel. Dunkin' Bagel. Smash in the coffee.